Okay, we're going to call the committee to order and get going. We don't have quorum yet, so we'll do that at some point midway through here, but there's a lot of people that want to testify on this, and I'd like to make sure we get everybody in if we can. So, Representative Meslow, we won't move your bill right now, but if you'd like to, and Representative Latz, if you'd like to kind of walk through it and give us the tour of the bill, and then we'll... What the plan is we will do, after your introduction, we will do 30 minutes of the advocate side and 30 minutes of the opponent side. And then we'll get to a discussion by the committee, and then if people offer amendments at that point, we'll take them as they come. So, Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hold on a second. We do have quorum, so... We'll call the committee to order officially. Sorry about the delay. Is there someone who would like to move the bill? The chair will move House File 405, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to civil law. Representative Meslow, proceed now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have one author's amendment. Would you like me to offer that after I've walked you through the bill?
Yeah, why don't we let's do that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 405 is known as the Freedom to Breathe Act. It extends many of the provisions of the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act. In particular, the bottom line is that it extends it to restaurants, and we'll talk about that as we move forward with the bill. On page one, in the definitions of public place, the definition of public place includes bars. Again, as we go forward, we'll have more on that subject. Page 1, line 27, continuing on to page 2, defines smoking as inhaling, exhaling, or the combustion of any cigar, cigarette, pipe, or other lighted smoking equipment. As we continue in section 3 of the bill, it requires proprietors in public places to post the smoking prohibition as it applies to that particular facility, and also requires that if smoking is banned in that facility, the proprietor is not to provide ashtrays. Permitted smoking is defined in section 4. That includes scientific studies, it includes Native American ceremonies, and it includes bars. This is the provision that was put in the Health and Human Services Committee. The language here is designed specifically off the Olmsted County model, which has since been adopted in other jurisdictions, including Ramsey County. What that does is define a bar as a place where over half of the profits or half of the revenues are derived from the sale of alcohol. That makes it a bar. If less than half the revenue is derived from alcohol, then it is a restaurant. Smoking is allowed in bars, not in restaurants. However, if the restaurant has a walled-off bar area with a separate ventilation system, then smoking would be permitted in that separate area. As we turn to page 4, we're still within section 4, but that then addresses private clubs. Smoking is allowed in private clubs as long as they are only serving club members and guests of club members. It then defines, as we go forward, what a club is. It needs to be something that has more than 25 members and can't discriminate. And other provisions such as that. Further in subdivision 5, the prohibition does not apply to restaurants that are closed to the public, simply being used for private functions. It does not apply to private homes, private residences, private automobiles, or hotel guest rooms, sleeping rooms. That leads us then to subdivision 6. Subdivision 6 provides that local governments can choose to enact stricter provisions if they choose to do so. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are the basic provisions of the bill. At this time, I would like to offer as an author's amendment what's identified as the A-17 amendment.
Okay, members, the A-17 amendment did not make the 24-hour rule. I've discussed this with Representative Meslow. I don't think it's particularly controversial, but sometimes there's differing opinions on that. If there's no objection, we'll go ahead and let the amendment be offered. Representative Mullery?
Mr. Chairman, could we have it explained first before we...
Okay. Representative Meslow, would you please explain the amendment?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mullery, I would be happy to do so. This is something that was brought forward by the retail tobacco store industry. Tom Bryant provided the language, and I'm indebted to him for that. What it does is permit smoking in a retail tobacco store if that is the basic business there. They can have some other incidental sales, but if the purpose of the business is the sale of tobacco and tobacco-related products, that it would permit smoking in that location. As I listened to Mr. Bryant and to some testifiers in HHS on this subject, it made sense to me that this bill is really about protection. The bill is about looking out for the health of employees and their exposure to secondhand smoke. Individuals who are working in retail tobacco stores are people who are involved in that business, in that process, and certainly are commonly already smoking and consuming tobacco products on their own. I don't think that they have the same kind of protection concerns, or I don't have the same kind of protection concerns for them when this is a business that is specifically related to the industry. I have spoken with the advocates who will be who have been involved in this issue on both sides, and I think there's pretty uniform agreement that this is a reasonable permitted use. And on that basis, I am going forward offering this as an author's amendment.
Any objections, members, to offering the amendment? Seeing none, the chair will move the A-17 amendment. Discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A-17 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Now I think we'll go to the testimony. What we'd like to do, just in order, since we have a lot of people and are wanting to testify, we're going to give each side half an hour. Going to go through this. I'd ask members to hold their questions to the end. You can write a note that if it's to a specific testifier, and we'll go through the members' questions as thoroughly as possible. We would like to get this bill final decision by the committee done by the end of this committee period. So, Dr. Richard Lusky. And I'd ask the testifiers to keep their testimony to about 3 minutes, and in order to respect the time for the rest of the testifiers, since we are trying to limit to about half an hour to be fair to each side. Please, and with all the witnesses, if you'd please state your name and any organization you're affiliated with right at the beginning, so we can expedite that for the time.
Good afternoon, folks. My name is Rich Lusky. I'm a neonatologist at Huntington Medical Center and a member of Huntington Faculty Associates. Good afternoon. I'm currently the co-medical director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at Hennepin County Medical Center. And I've passed out my testimony, so hopefully folks can look at it as we go along.
Chair, for the witness, hold the...
Could you please pull the microphone a little closer so we can hear you? Thank you.
I've practiced in the field of newborn medicine for more than 17 years, and I'm also a member of the board of directors for Marchadines and the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm here to speak to you in strong support of this legislation on behalf of both of these organizations, Marchadines and Academy of Pediatrics, the obstetrical and pediatric health care providers across our state, and most importantly, the very future of our great state of Minnesota, the babies, infants, and children of the state of Minnesota. Children's exposure to tobacco smoke during fetal development and via early childhood environmental smoke exposure is probably the most common and hazardous of all of children's environmental exposures. Exposure to cigarette smoking is without a doubt the largest and most important known modifiable risk factor for low birth weight and premature birth and infant death. When considering pediatric environmental health, it is very important to be aware that there are critical periods of development during which exposure to environmental toxins will cause lifelong effects on the maturation, growth, and function of children's bodies. The developing fetus is more susceptible to the adverse effects of tobacco, including the carcinogenic and DNA damage, because of their very immature metabolic pathways. They're not able to handle the toxins and break them down as readily as older children and adults. Over the years, there's been steady progress in the scientific knowledge related to the adverse effects of tobacco, starting first with the adult population, then the pediatric population, and now including younger children, infants, babies, and fetuses. Nicotine is shown to cause vasoconstriction of the uterine arteries that supply blood to the developing fetus, effectively decreasing blood flow to the fetus during the development in utero. Carbon monoxide that is found in tobacco smoke has been shown to impair fetal oxygenation. Nicotine readily crosses the placenta, with fetal concentrations having been shown to be as much as 15% higher in the fetus than in maternal concentrations. Studies have shown that maternal exposure to secondhand smoke, when mom is not smoking, she's just been exposed to the secondhand smoke, can result in nicotine levels in the developing fetus as high as that seen in babies born to moms that are light smokers, and that's defined as one pack per day. The adverse effects of tobacco exposure are seen in every trimester of pregnancy, from an increased rate of abortions in the first trimester to an increased rate of premature births and lower birth weights in the final trimester. There's no known safe level of exposure to tobacco that would prevent its adverse effects on the growth, respiratory function, behavior, and development of babies and infants. It's been shown that secondhand smoke exposure has been linked to increased incidence of premature labor, premature delivery, spontaneous abortions, and stillbirths. Premature delivery is the leading cause of death in the first year, in the first month of life. In my work at Hennepin County Medical Center's newborn ICU, I witnessed firsthand the devastation of premature birth in infants born small for gestational age. The lifelong impact on these children, their family, and the economic consequences to the family and society at large is immense. It is truly difficult for me to describe adequately in words what families experience when their dream of a healthy pregnancy and baby is cut short. I see it on a daily basis. Can I just add the last paragraph? And I probably put too much into the testimony, but I think this last paragraph is very important. I love what I do as a clinical practicing neonatologist, but all I can do is to try to take care of one baby at a time and when possible to pick up the pieces in extraordinarily difficult situations. You as legislators have the ability to impact the health of the population of the state, much more so than I can. What a true gift that is, and I sincerely hope you use it wisely. You can truly make a difference in the lives of infants, children, and the families. It is the right of every child to be born healthy and to be raised in a healthy environment. They can't speak for themselves, but you can. And I appreciate the time that you've given me today. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Patrick Wright?
Chairman Wilkin, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Wright. I'm a specialist in pulmonary diseases at the Minnesota Lung Center. I am here today on behalf of the 10,000 physician, medical residents, and medical students of the Minnesota Medical Association in support of the Freedom to Breathe Act. I applaud Representatives Meslow and Lutz for allowing, and others, for bringing forward this important legislation. Minnesota was the first state to enact clean indoor air legislation and to protect Minnesota workers from harmful effects of secondhand smoke. Now it is time that the right to breathe clean air is extended to all Minnesota workers, including bar and restaurant employees. It is not surprising that physicians are concerned about secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke affects tens of thousands of non-smokers each year. It causes lung cancer, respiratory illnesses, and heart disease. Smoke from cigarettes and from smoke exhaled by smokers makes up a dangerous haze with more than 50 cancer-causing ingredients. arsenic and formaldehyde are among them. The EPA has classified secondhand smoke as a Class A carcinogen. The scientific community has reached a consensus. Secondhand smoke is a very serious health hazard. Further, secondhand smoke in bars and restaurants adds unnecessary expense to the health costs in the state of Minnesota. As the legislature struggles to control health care costs in Minnesota, we need to do everything we can to protect people from diseases we can prevent. Diseases caused by tobacco not only cause human misery and sometimes death, they are expensive to treat. By adopting this legislation, you can do what thousands of Minnesota physicians cannot. We can only treat the diseases that are caused by exposure to smoke, including secondhand smoke. But you have the ability to protect our patients, Minnesota workers, from secondhand smoke and truly prevent lung cancers, heart disease, emphysema, and other respiratory illnesses. I urge you to pass the Freedom to Breathe Act, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Ann Murray.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ann Murray. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, and everyone to speak today. I'm Dr. Ann Murray. I'm working at Hennepin County Medical Center as an internist and specialized in geriatrics. I'm also an epidemiologist. I'm also treasurer of the Hennepin Medical Society and represent both the Hennepin Medical Society and Hennepin County Medical Center. And I'd just like to say that, to me, this bill is, as Representative Meslow stated, a bill about protection. And we can protect a lot of people with this bill. In essence, it is a form of vaccination against secondhand smoke. As a physician working in a large metropolitan hospital that serves the indigent, I see the health impact of smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke on a daily basis. Unfortunately, those who are low income and without health insurance are frequently the names and faces behind the statistics we hear when we talk about secondhand smoke. Currently, the only people who do not have protection under the Minnesota Clean Air Act are the hospitality employees, waiters, waitresses, bartenders, and especially dishwashers and busboys, the people behind the scenes in the kitchen. Frequently, these are people with little education and few job skills. Very rarely do they get health insurance from their employer. They are forced to work in smoke-filled environments for long periods of time. This is a group of people that literally cannot afford to get sick. Not only do they lose the opportunity to earn money, but they also do not have health insurance to pay for the medical bills. According to the AMA, the American Medical Society, being a waitress is the most hazardous occupation for women. Compared to other female workers, waitresses are almost four times as likely to die from lung cancer and 2.5 times as likely to die from heart disease because of their prolonged exposure to secondhand smoke. Waitresses don't have an option of saying, I don't want to work in the smoking section tonight. Most of the time, if you talk to waitresses, they'll say, I got stuck working it last night and I'm sick again this morning. I ask you, why are waitresses and other workers who are routinely exposed to secondhand smoke not protected to the same degree that you and I are? I have to add that at this point, I'm really embarrassed to live in Minnesota. 20 years ago, when I was a resident at Mayo, Dick Kunt introduced the first legislation and really pushed for clean air in Minnesota. Now we're laggards in the country, and there's no reason for this. What it says to me is that we as a state value the profits of the hospitality industry more than the health of our workers, and especially the indigent workers. As policymakers, you have the opportunity to greatly improve people's health and quality of life by making Minnesota smoke-free. You have the opportunity to vaccinate these workers against secondhand smoke. I envy your position, and your decision will have a greater impact than the cumulative impact of my entire medical career and all of the physicians. I urge you to choose wisely and not squander this opportunity to proclaim that the health of workers is more important than the profits of the hospitality industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stephen Heck.
Good afternoon. I'm Stephen Heck of the Cancer Center and Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at the University of Minnesota. I'm Wallen Professor of Cancer Prevention. I'm also an American Cancer Society research professor, one of a select group of 30 in the United States. I've conducted peer-reviewed research on tobacco and cancer funded by the United States National Cancer Institute and other agencies for over 30 years. I've published over 550 papers in the scientific literature, many of which deal with mechanisms and prevention of tobacco-induced cancer. In 2004, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, a branch of the World Health Organization of the United Nations, published Volume 83 of its authoritative, influential, and highly respected series, Monographs on the Evaluation of Carcinogenic Risks to Humans. The topic was tobacco smoke and involuntary smoking. Involuntary smoking, the exposure of non-smokers to secondhand tobacco smoke, also known as environmental tobacco smoke, is the subject of my presentation today. In order to evaluate the relationship between involuntary smoking and cancer, IARC convened a working group of 28 well-known experts on tobacco and cancer in Lyon, France, for a 10-day period. The working group evaluated the world's literature on the subject of involuntary smoking and cancer. I was a member of that working group. With respect to lung cancer, the working group evaluated more than 50 epidemiologic studies that have been carried out in the past 25 years, mostly investigating lung cancer in non-smoking spouses of smokers. Most of these studies showed a significantly increased risk of lung cancer. Meta-analyses of pooled data showed significantly increased risk of about 20% in non-smoking spouses of smokers. Studies of secondhand tobacco smoke exposure in the workplace showed increased risk of lung cancer of 12 to 19%. The working group unanimously concluded that involuntary smoking is a cause of lung cancer in never smokers and that involuntary smoking is carcinogenic to humans. This conclusion agreed with those of several other highly respected panels in the U.S. that evaluated this question, including the Surgeon General, the National Research Council, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the California Environmental Protection Agency. Ladies and gentlemen, exposure to secondhand smoke is a cause of lung cancer. This is beyond debate. At an earlier hearing on the Freedom to Breathe Act, one person testified that cancer risks associated with coffee, cell phones, and cheeseburgers are equivalent to those of secondhand smoke. This is quite simply nonsense. Secondhand smoke is also an accepted cause of heart disease, sudden infant death syndrome, low birth weight, asthma, acute lower respiratory tract illness in children, and middle ear infections in children. My research group at the University of Minnesota has studied the ways in which cancer-causing agents, or carcinogens, in cigarette smoke cause lung cancer and other cancers in humans. First, let us be clear. Secondhand smoke contains all the same carcinogens that mainstream tobacco smoke, the smoke inhaled by a smoker, contains. This is one reason why the relationship between involuntary smoking and cancer is so plausible. The only difference between regular smoking and involuntary smoking is dose. The dose of carcinogens to the involuntary smoker is far less, about 1 to 5% of that to a smoker. Therefore, the risk for cancer is less, but as already mentioned, demonstrably real. My research group has carried out several studies in Minnesota in which we have measured the uptake of tobacco carcinogens in non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke. We have focused on a tobacco-specific lung carcinogen called NNK. This carcinogen causes lung cancer in all animal species in which it has been tested and is classified by IARC as a human carcinogen. In order to assess uptake of NNK in non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke, we measure one of its breakdown products called NNAL in urine. When NNAL is present in the urine of a non-smoker, its only source could be exposure to secondhand smoke. We've studied four groups of non-smokers in Minnesota: spouses of smokers, school children, people who spend time in the smoking section of a gambling casino, and workers in bars and restaurants. In all cases, we demonstrated significant uptake of the lung carcinogen NNK in these non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke. In summary, there is no question that involuntary smoking is a cause of lung cancer and other diseases. Uptake of a tobacco-specific lung carcinogen by non-smokers in Minnesota bars, restaurants, and casinos has been conclusively demonstrated. We must act now to prevent the unacceptable health risks of exposure to secondhand smoke in Minnesota. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Mark Manley.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Manley. I am also a physician, and I am the director of the Center for Tobacco Reduction and Health Improvement at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. Prior to joining Blue Cross, I worked at the National Cancer Institute for 12 years, where I was chief of the Tobacco Control Research Branch. But I thank you today for the opportunity to testify on the Freedom to Breathe Act. Blue Cross is among the many organizations that enthusiastically support this bill. The issue of secondhand smoke has been studied very thoroughly, and the conclusions of the research, which you've heard about, are very consistent. When smoke-free environments are created, everyone wins. You've heard the science about the impact of secondhand smoke on health, and I will not repeat any of that. I think the facts that you've heard more than justify passing this bill. I would point out that the costs of treating the diseases caused by secondhand smoke are significant. In the U.S., if we could reduce the cost, we could reduce the cost of treating heart disease alone by $224 million if all workplaces were smoke-free. What you may not have considered is that this legislation also has other beneficiaries other than the non-smokers whose exposure would be eliminated. Smokers, too, would benefit from this legislation. More than half of all smokers try to quit smoking each year, and very few succeed. But smoke-free areas actually help people who are trying to quit smoking. Creating smoke-free environments not only encourages people to try to quit, but it makes their attempts to quit more successful. The tobacco industry itself agrees with us on this point according to their own internal memos. And so helping people who are trying to quit is a huge benefit of this legislation. Right now, smoking costs the nation about $150 billion every year. This includes $75.5 billion in health and medical expenses, so that each pack of cigarettes sold in the United States costs the nation an estimated $7.18 in medical care costs and lost productivity. In Minnesota, we pay about $1.6 billion in health care costs for the diseases caused by smoking and another $1 billion in lost productivity. The costs of health care are paid by employers who purchase health insurance and by the state and federal governments. In this time of concern about rising health care costs, this is exactly the type of legislation that will help to bring down the cost of treating diseases caused by tobacco. Businesses also, including restaurants and bars, benefit from this legislation. Businesses are more profitable when they are smoke-free. Smoke-free workplaces help workers who are trying to quit smoking. And businesses are more profitable when fewer of their employees smoke. They have fewer health care costs. There is less absenteeism. Workers' compensation payments are reduced. The fear that clean air will harm restaurants and bar business is just that, a fear. But clean air is good for these businesses. In Duluth, restaurant and bar business increased after a clean indoor air bill was passed. The same occurred in New York City, where they saw an increase in business and employment in restaurants and bars. California has also watched business and employment increase in its bars and restaurants since they became smoke-free. At Blue Cross, we care about this legislation because it will improve the health of Minnesotans. And by improving their health, it helps to control health care costs, which is something that we all care about. Non-smokers, smokers, workers, and employers all will benefit if this legislation passes. The data is in, and all of the myths have been debunked, and the time for Minnesota to resume its leadership role and protect its citizens is now. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Manley. Pat McCone.
Good afternoon. My name is Pat McCone. I'm the Director of Tobacco Control for the American Lung Association of Minnesota, based out of Duluth. We're all entitled to our own set of opinions, and I'm sure you are too. But there is only one set of facts around secondhand smoke and economic impact in Duluth. Duluth has a city sales tax on both food-only sales and food with alcohol. And I have provided to you in handouts those charts over the last 4 years, showing you that in no period since we passed our first ordinance in 2000 and implemented in 2001 has business gone down. Business has gone up, and business has gone up dramatically for the smoke-free restaurants. A business closed this week in Duluth and blamed it on the smoking ban. It was a bar called Sharks. I'll just take one quote. "We opted to keep smoking, and it didn't work." All right. The last two restaurants to go out of business in the Duluth Superior community were in Superior, Wisconsin, which allowed smoking throughout its business. You're going to hear from the opposition today, and quite frankly, you're going to not hear about health. You're going to hear about freedom to choose. I'm a child of the 60s and 70s, and I value independence and freedom as much as anyone else. You're going to hear about businesses being quasi-public places where you can be discriminated by the color of your shoes. But I would tell you, if you walk into one of those restaurants barefoot, you would be asked to leave because of a public health reason. You're not going to hear about science. You're going to hear anecdotal stories about business workplace loss. I'm going to ask you to show me the numbers. You're going to hear that workers have a choice and they can go somewhere else. As a parent of two children who both first jobs were in the restaurant business at age 15 and 16, I'm telling you there are not many other places for children to go to get jobs. I think it is disrespectful and condescending to tell our children, if you don't like it at an unsafe workplace, just go somewhere else. You're going to hear that it's a legal product. We're not here to ban tobacco use in Minnesota. It is a legal product. This is about where you use tobacco, just like you can't light up in this room. This is about simply not lighting up in a workplace. You're going to hear what's next, cheeseburgers? Well, when your cheeseburger affects my health and their secondhand cheeseburgers, we'll talk. I'm sitting here looking at some of you who represent communities that I grew up in. I'm an Iron Ranger, very proud that Virginia, my school, my alma mater, is on its way to a state tournament. I know that citizens throughout this state have the momentum and the will for this to happen. Should this not pass in your committee, I tell you, we are passionate. We are passionate because we know people are dying. We will be back. We will hold you accountable. And we will continue to work for health. And the momentum that you'll see next year after the metropolitan area experiences smoke-free will be overwhelming. Thank you.
Very much. Joe Powers.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm Joe Powers. I'm the owner of Canadian Honker Restaurant in Rochester. I've been in the restaurant business for about 30 years, and in particular owned my own restaurant for the last 21 years. First, I'd like to state that I'm not a doctor, and I'm the farthest thing from it, and so I'm going to stick with the issues of business. There's a note that I keep by my desk. It goes like this. One of the biggest struggles with change is when we overestimate the value of what we have and underestimate the value of what we may gain because of the change. I think it goes right to the point that we're talking about today. The fears of a smoke-free place and business, especially of what I've been through in Rochester, is totally over-exaggerated. The smoke-free ordinance in Rochester has only affected those businesses that were in trouble before. Quite frankly, I can only think of two businesses since the ordinance went into play that went out of business. We gave them an excuse. Rochester has added 32 restaurants and 1,000 seats since the ordinance has gone into effect. It no longer is an issue. People rarely talk about it. Quite frankly, it wasn't an issue 60 days after it went into place. It was the press that continued to try to find a story. The story in the last year and a half, 2 years, is nowhere. Corporate America is the leader in the restaurant business. I'm talking about TGI Fridays, Applebee's, Outback's, Chili's, and Red Lobster's, just to name a few. They all have one thing in common. Their bars are in the middle of their restaurants. To me, they should be nervous because most smokers migrate into those areas. I would ask you, legislators, have you been contacted by corporate America on this issue? To my knowledge, not. the amount of complaints that happened in my restaurant the year before the ordinance went into place was enormous. I've been in the restaurant business my whole life. At one time, it was no big deal. I'll sit in smoking. Then it decreased. They did not want to no longer sit in smoking. It was really an issue. The issue became because of what society has become. The health issues are real. And I don't think it's fair for my workers or the people that work for me that don't smoke. And you'll hear people say, well, they can find jobs in other places. Well, what we went through 6 or 7 years ago when we were begging for people to work in our places, it wasn't like that. And those folks had to work in the smoking sections. I've had 10% of my staff quit smoking since the ordinance went into effect. If you're a good business operator, this ordinance will not affect your business. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Now for testimony in opposition of the bill, Jim Farrell. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Farrell.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jim Farrell. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, commonly referred to as the MLBA, which is a statewide trade association of license holders that sell alcohol both on and off sale. It is the oldest and largest organization of its type. It's in its 52nd year this year. You're going to be receiving, hopefully soon, our position statement, which you can find on our website about the issue. But more importantly, you're going to be receiving behind that some pictures of some folks that I would like to share with you, people that I represent. The first one is Helen and Glenn Whiting from Vining, Minnesota, up in the northwestern part of the state up by Alexandria. If any of you have ever been there, I call it the Big Purple Palace. And it's in a very small town called Vining. Glenn and Helen, if they were here today, but they can't be because the two of them put in about 60 hours a week. They don't have maybe one or two part-time employees, and so they are at their establishment unable to come down and tell you how scared they are that if you were to pass a smoking ban that would not have any exemptions, such as the state of New York, that they're afraid that their retirement would disappear. Because you see, their business is their retirement. They've worked all their lives in this business. They've saved hard. And hopefully someday they can turn it over to someone else and use that money to retire on. Please keep in mind that the proposal for a total ban, which was originally discussed, was a ban that has not been done anywhere without exemptions. New York State, which is a cold weather state like ours, has exemptions in their ban. If you look also, the next picture is of Dave and Vina Gravett of the Abbey up in Aurora, Minnesota. And the Gravettes are very scared because they just went through the closing of the taconite plant in Hoyt Lakes. And they are afraid that if you were to do this today and harm their business, that they would be hurt. And their fear is about the 50-50 that dram shop rates are so high in the state of Minnesota that they feel they must sell more food than alcohol. Otherwise, they can't afford dram shop. And so they're afraid that you'll do anything and you'll hurt them. And it's kind of hard to watch their fear these days because most folks who represent Rukavina and represent Sturgis can tell you on the Iron Range are good, hardworking people that haven't done anything wrong to be harmed. The next picture is of Jimmy and Karen Harris of Northeast Minneapolis. That has been an establishment that's been in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm sure Representative Mulray could tell us for quite some time. And They are afraid because they're now looking at a total ban at the end of this month in Minneapolis, and they're scared. And I'm seeing the time sign. And the last one is of Tom and Jerry Plates. As you can see, they're not corporate America. They're just regular folks living the American dream. And they've asked me to ask you to not hurt them. I'd finally like to say that I am very pleased that the author of this bill was Representative Meslow. We're all aware of the trying time that he's been through, but I can tell you that no one has treated me with more dignity and grace in an opposition setting. This issue brings out all folks, and unfortunately we fail sometimes to understand what Representative Mary Murphy tried to teach me, and that was that the task at hand was not as important as the person that I would be sitting across from. It's taken me a long time to understand that, and I just want to acknowledge that I think Doug is one heck of a human being. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Dave Siegel?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I apologize. I have a little bit of I'm on the downside, so don't worry, but I'm recovering from the cold. So if my voice cracks a little bit, I apologize. My name is Dave Siegel, and I'm the president and CEO of Hospitality Minnesota. We're the umbrella organization for the Minnesota Restaurant Association, the Minnesota Hotel and Lodging Association, and the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. I've been on the job since January 1 of this year, so just about 60 days into my new position, and I'm really enjoying it. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide some testimony to you today. This is the first time I've ever had the opportunity to testify in front of a Minnesota committee, House or Senate, so I consider it a great honor and a privilege to be part of the legislative process. Our basic philosophy as an organization is that government should play a limited role in the affairs of business, and that banning smoking in restaurants and bars is not an appropriate allocation or application of government intervention. We believe that the individual business owners, not government, should make the decision on whether or not to permit smoking in their establishments. State law, as you know, already requires restaurants to offer smoking and non-smoking sections, and an increasing number of establishments are going smoke-free on their own. Restaurants have on average 60 to 75% smoke-free seating, despite the current law, which mandates only 30%. Lodging rooms across the state, we estimate, are about 75% smoke-free, despite the fact that the Clean Indoor Air Act and this legislation does not address the lodging industry. Further, 25 to 30% of the restaurants in the state were already smoke-free before any of the city mandates took effect or will take effect. This demonstrates that market forces do work, and that the customers of these businesses are in fact dictating to a great degree the actions of these restaurateurs. We hope you'll let restaurants continue to adapt to their customers' needs and wishes. Let the customer vote with his or her pocketbook. This is a far more appropriate tool to encourage restaurateurs to address smoking issues than a government mandate. As the demographics of the dining public have changed and continue to change, so too has the restaurant industry. More and more restaurants continue to go smoke-free on their own. The second area of concern regarding this legislation is the negative impact it will have economically on the hospitality industry. Opponents have cited surveys that suggest that the economic impact is minimal. And I've also seen similar surveys that suggest that the economic impact is in fact significant. But at its simplest level, we can all agree that as a result of this legislation, some restaurants will close. Some employees will lose their jobs. I personally experienced the state enacting a statewide smoking ban as executive director of the Maine Innkeepers Association, where I worked for the previous 5 years. I worked closely with the State Restaurant Association there during the painful, and I mean painful, transition to a smoke-free environment. Restaurants closed, jobs were lost, and business was affected. Will some restaurants benefit? Yes. Some businesses will thrive and find ways to adapt. However, for businesses that cater to smokers or more diverse crowds, their hands will be tied and their business will be hurt. In the land of opportunity and choice, the government wants to take away those abilities to accommodate all guests. The freedom to be hospitable is being taken away by those that are intolerant of smokers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Dale Swobinski? Is Dale here? Ken Rockler?
Chairman, welcome. Members of the committee, my name is Ken Rockler and I represent the Tavern League of Minnesota and the Bowling Proprietors Association. Additionally, I'm one of the owners at Billy's Lighthouse in Long Lake, where we voluntarily went non-smoking 8 months ago. I've been involved in the ownership, design, and operation of restaurants, taverns, and bowling centers for 37 years. If I tried to tell you that I was capable of performing open heart surgery on any one of you or your family, I hope you'd run for the hills. I hope when proponents of the bans try and tell you what our customers and our employees want, even though those same customers and employees tell us the opposite, that you'll trust that we do know what our businesses need. What really happens when smoking bans are forced on the hospitality industry? Don't be fooled by the proponents' misleading statements regarding sales tax figures in general. We're like most other businesses. We don't eat in the general. We eat in the specific. So while not all restaurants are hurt, witness the fact that we voluntarily went non-smoking in our dining room, many of them suffer a disaster. I just today received a website that showed that in New York, where the proponents said everybody's doing fine, there have already been 165 exemptions granted, about a 1-in-3 ratio at this time. Also, I heard somebody testify that waitresses are constantly saying, I had to work in the no-smoking section. I have literally had thousands of waitresses that worked for me in my restaurants over the years. Not only has not one of them ever said that, but we would never have had any trouble accommodating that. It's been about 7 or 8 years since I've been in active management, but I don't imagine it's changed that much right now. Nobody's talked about the idea of what happens going outside. Going outside is not a viable option for an awful lot of restaurants. I have a member here, Fabulous Ferns. They've already been warned by their landlord and the neighbors that they don't want anybody walking outside to have a cigarette. I would imagine that you know hundreds of establishments throughout Minnesota that the neighbors are not going to be excited about people walking outside at 10 o'clock. Also, the Tavern League of Minnesota inquired of 3 life insurance agents last week about the difference in premiums in California, where they've had 8 years of no smoking in bars and restaurants, and in states like Minnesota, where there is already allowed smoking and still is allowed there. There's no difference. I know of no business that's more actuarial conscious than the life insurance business. They do not rate it one bit different. These are public places, not private places. They need to appeal to the largest portion of the public that they can. Trust me, as the public demands it, more and more of us will convert more and more of our space, or almost the entire space, to non-smoking. The one thing I do agree with the opposition is they say, wait until you see the results of Hennepin County. I implore you to see the same thing. I'm not hoping for it, and I don't think that anybody there is hoping for it, but you're going to see some carnage there. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Rockler. Ryan Siga?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Pasiga. I'm an attorney that represents a group of bars and restaurants that are opposed to the ban. They call themselves Minnesotans Against Smoking Bans. I'm here to talk about the effect on primarily on revenue that this proposed ban would have. It is true that if the ban passes, some bars and restaurants will actually come out okay from this. They might even come out better than they're doing now. But other bars and restaurants will suffer. They will go out of business. How do I know this? Because I talked to a network of lawyers around the nation that are challenging smoking bans at local and statewide levels, and I talked to their clients. And I've talked to women in Toledo, in New York, and men in California, and they've told me about the effects of business in their local areas, whether they have a local or state ban. New York, for example, has lost $77 million in revenues and $50 million in wages and 3,000 jobs since the ban went into effect. California's ban has closed over 1,000 businesses, and this effect has been rippling throughout the country wherever smoking bans are imposed. You should also know that several communities have enacted local bans only to repeal them later after they've seen the real effects that this has on business throughout their area. I talked to a woman who owns a bar in Toledo, Ohio, after they had a local ban, and she told me that 5 minutes away at the Michigan border, the bars were full, where her bar, she lost $45,000, had to put that back into the bar, and they saved it at the last minute by rolling back the ban. As you've heard, other bans have exemptions in them that permit hardship exceptions for bars and restaurants. Our ban does not have that. The proposed ban does not. Moreover, as you may know, Iowa and Washington, their Supreme Courts recently struck down local bans as unconstitutional. What I'm also particularly concerned about is where we're at right now. As you know, Ramsey County, the city of Minneapolis, the city of Bloomington, and Hennepin County have enacted local bans. The Bloomington, Minneapolis, and Hennepin bans are set to take effect March 31st. I do not know if any of you have had an opportunity to review those bans in detail, but I have, and I'll tell you that there are irreconcilable differences between the bans. That won't matter between Minneapolis and Bloomington, but what are you going to do when you've got a city ban and a county ban that are irreconcilable? I'll tell you what's going to happen. There's going to be challenges in the courts all the way up. They're going to start at the district court level, and they're going to carry up to the Supreme Court, and this is going to cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, as these challenges and local bans make their way up. Why do I point this out? Because the House file on the last page seeks to repeal Section 144.415 of the Clean Indoor Air Act. That is the provision in the Clean Indoor Air Act that the people who have enacted local bans believe they get their authority to do so under. As you know, the Clean Indoor Air Act has a provision that says that proprietors can designate smoking areas within their restaurants or bars as long as it doesn't conflict with the fire marshal or other ordinance or rule. So they look to that and they think that they have authority to enact a local ban, and there is an attorney general opinion pertaining to restaurants that has found that as well. But the House file here and its companion over in the Senate actually both seek to repeal that language and replace it with much clearer language that allows home rule or charter cities or counties from enacting and enforcing more stringent measures to protect individuals from secondhand smoke. That's on the last page, lines 8 through 11. And here's the problem. If the Clean Indoor Air Act is not uniform and is not applied from county to county and is not a statewide ban, but you let counties do this, whether or not this bill passes, you're going to have irreconcilable differences between city and county bans, and this needs to be addressed. This ban should not allow patchwork enforcement. It's going to lead to lawsuits all over the place. This ban is going to affect businesses. Some businesses will go out of business. Some will suffer detrimentally, and they will be sold. This is more than about health. This is a lot more about health. This is about private property rights, and it is about business. And if you think it's only about health, as the proponents tell you, I can show you a document that I've uncovered that was provided to the Bloomington City Council by a commission that the City Council hired. And in that document, the commission said, and I'm paraphrasing, we need to emphasize the health issue here and get away from the negative effect that these bans will have on business. They're acknowledging that there's going to be that effect there. It is real. You are going to hurt people. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. James Algeo?
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilkin and members of the committee. My name is Jim Algeo. I'm a resident of Bloomington. I speak in opposition to this bill not as a representative of any one particular business, but rather as a member of four veteran or service organizations that also happen to be involved in charitable gambling. First, I want to point out what everyone should know, but nobody mentions. This proposed legislation is a classic representation of a class struggle pitting the haves against the have-nots. On one side, you have the anti-smoking zealots who will go to any length to impose a utopian view of society on everyone else. They see themselves as protectors of the common good, yet what they really want is for all the non-believers to submit to their will. I'm amazed they don't carry banners stating, God is on our side. Smokers, well, they just want to be left alone to maintain the status quo. They know that they are a dying breed, pun intended. But the reason they are adults engaged in a perfectly legal activity. They understand and have accepted the risks involved in smoking. This shrinking minority now, more than ever, is comprised mainly of the working class, those people whose jobs are working in the trenches, struggling to make a better life for themselves and their families. How many of you stop in at your local watering hole after work to meet friends, have a few drinks, and solve the problems of the world? Maybe watch a sporting event, or listen to a jukebox, or dance to a band. You may not, but plenty of your constituents do. If you did, you'd know that even though only 20 to 25% of the adult population are still smokers, they comprise closer to 50% or more of the patrons of local pubs, clubs, and bingo halls. That's the setup, now here's the delivery. This bill will not significantly impact the corporate restaurants and lounges, the TGI Fridays, the Perkins, and such. They will have the financial wherewithal to absorb this legislation and continue with their operations. It will most certainly contribute to the demise of many of the locally owned pubs and clubs, the final straw in a long battle against the expansion of corporate competition. The ramifications of that should be sufficient to give you pause. If bars and clubs close or downsize, the first to suffer will be charitable gambling. Most of the non-casino gambling in the state is done in the small, family-owned bars as well as veterans clubs, fraternal clubs, and bingo halls. Let's be logical for a minute. Let's make an assumption that some operations will suffer financially because their patrons can no longer smoke in their establishment. If that statement is true, and it is also true that most of the charitable gambling occurs in these establishments, then it is logical to assume that charitable gambling will suffer as well. Now think of those who benefit from charitable gambling activity. Charitable gambling draws patrons to an establishment, and many of those patrons who gamble also eat and drink there, helping to add to the bottom line profitability of the bar or club. Now think of all the money that charitable gambling generates. Since 1985, it has returned $1.3 billion back into our communities and $830 million in taxes to the state. If gambling suffers, who will make up the shortfall of the community and the state coffers? You know, say it with me, the taxpayers will have to pick up the slack. On a private test, and I assume the anti-smoking juggernaut will sooner or later find enough support to enact restrictive legislation. If you can't defeat them outright, I would urge you to offer and vote for amendments such as loss waivers for any business that could demonstrate to their license provider significant financial loss directly attributable to the effects of a smoking ban. Exemption for bars as well as all veterans and fraternal clubs and bingo operations, and preemption of any city or county smoking bans. Government should not be an onerous burden on its citizens, yet it has an obligation to provide an equal basis for the pursuit of freedom, justice, and the American way. Adult smoking is a lawful activity, and those who choose to smoke are certainly aware of the risks and consequences of their actions. Non-smoking adults should be intelligent enough to avoid the risks and the consequences of smoking by simply not patronizing establishments where smoking is permitted. Let the free enterprise system continue to work, and vote no on any smoking ban in bars, clubs, and bingo halls. And I thank you.
Thank you. Mark Wernemont.
Thank you, Chairman Wilkins, committee members. My name is Mark Wernemont, and I've been selling and engineering ventilation systems to the hospitality industry for 15 years. Somebody earlier said that nobody here is going to talk science today. Well, I'm going to talk science and facts today. The traditional argument in favor of a government-mandated smoking ban is that secondhand smoke is a public health hazard. And while nobody is arguing that smoking is not a hazard to the smoker, new Environmental Health Department tests prove secondhand smoke is nowhere near a level of approaching a health hazard. OSHA regulates all substances which are deemed to be a health hazard and determines a PEL, or a permissible exposure limit, which is safe. For instance, carbon dioxide, which is fatal at a concentration of 20%, but which we all inhale at a concentration of 4% with every breath, is regulated by OSHA to be safe at 9,000 milligrams per cubic meter. In establishing a PEL for secondhand smoke, OSHA has determined that the safe level is 0.5 milligrams per cubic meter of airborne nicotine. In third quarter 2004, the City of St. Louis Park, Minnesota's Environmental Health Department, completed air quality testing for secondhand smoke in its 19 bars and restaurants, which allow smoking. The St. Louis Park Health Department began testing early in 2004, measuring secondhand smoke in milligrams per cubic meter. However, all of their results came back at zero. So what they did next is they retested in micrograms per cubic meter. In other words, concentrations 1,000 times smaller than the OSHA guidelines. With these new test parameters, results came in ranging from 1 to 32 micrograms per cubic meter, with the median result coming in at 3.3 micrograms per cubic meter. The top number is the actual readings from St. Louis Park's Health Environmental Health Department. The bottom number is what OSHA deems safe, permissible exposure limit of airborne nicotine. Oh, by the way, maybe I can pass these packets up to you folks. Anyway, the median result was 3.3 micrograms per cubic meter. It happens to be the St. Louis Park Applebee's, which has two of our smoke eater systems installed in their facility. These results, 3.3 micrograms per cubic meter, are a full 150 times safer than OSHA permissible levels of secondhand smoke. And in fact, the last 2 weeks, I've been fielding a lot of calls nationwide and emails nationwide from areas where there have been smoking bans implemented and areas where smoking bans are going to be implemented, because everybody is interested in this new proof that up until now, nobody has tested for. One might ask then, why other states ban smoking if the readings are so insignificant? After all, the air quality with regard to nicotine in the median bar restaurant in St. Louis Park was 150 times safer than what OSHA PEL allows. The answer? No other health department ever tested. They simply believed the rhetoric, feelings spouted by the usual suspects. In other words, St. Louis Park Environmental Health Department has scientifically proven that secondhand smoke is not the health hazard talked about, and therefore should not be forcefully banned. Private bars and restaurants can voluntarily ban smoking as free market forces may dictate, but scientific proof has determined that a government mandate is not required. But one final argument I would like to address is the notion that now that some local governments such as Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Minneapolis, and Blooming have banned smoking, the state should follow suit to level the playing field. That's a great idea. So all bars and restaurants can equally lose 15 to 30% of their income, which is what is happening to neighborhood bars in New York State. This scenario is not the state's job, especially now that the health department tests prove secondhand smoke is not a public health hazard. What is the state legislator's job, though, is ensuring that local governments are not passing laws which restrict legal tax revenue generating streams. Cigarette tax revenues are part of the Minnesota tax base. Cut that base, and it's the same as raising taxes on all Minnesotans or further cutting spending on programs such as education. If this legislation is going to pass any new laws with regard to smoking, it ought to be that local governments do not have the authority to pass laws banning smoking, which in turn further decrease state revenues.
Thank you, Mr. Werneman. Sue Jeffers.
Well, how come there are so many of you here? The committees are usually much smaller. But anyway, hi, Sue Jeffers. I own Seven Herbs Bar and Restaurant. For 25 years, I've quietly run my business, look out for my staff and customers, paid millions of dollars in taxes and wages, and until recently, have never felt the need to come to Capitol Hill. I have now met with and talked over 100 of the 202 elected officials, and I would like to thank most of you for your support and encouragement. Many of you agree the rights of the anti-smoking advocates end at my front door. During the committee hearings, I've listened to restaurant owners testify how good a smoking ban is for their businesses. To think an owner in Moose Lake, Minnesota, or Rochester would be able to tell me how to run my college bar in Minneapolis, or the vets how to run their VFW in Bloomington, is outright ridiculous. The exploitation of an 11-year-old boy with CF at the Senate Commerce hearing shows just how low the smokeaters have sunk. To think an anti-smoking advocate is an expert on anything more than furthering their well-funded social and political agenda is even more ridiculous. Secondhand smoke will become known as one of the biggest frauds ever perpetuated on our society. Other states have already figured it out. Six have voted down total smoking bans in their state, and two states with total smoking bans already have legislation on the table to repeal their bans. The stunning defeat of the smokeaters in Duluth and Moorhead when they spoke at the ballot box said the voters in Minnesota value property rights. We know the science behind the secondhand smoke fraud is questionable at best. We know OSHA has determined safe levels for secondhand smoke, and we know St. Louis Park has determined secondhand smoke to be 150 times lower than the OSHA safety thresholds. I'd also like to point out in the last 6 months I've had 5 employees go home ill. 4 were non-smokers. The smokeaters wasted millions of dollars practicing to buy these smoking bans before they headed here. Today they ran a full-page ad in the Pioneer Press and the Star and Tribune. $20,000 of our taxpayers to run this ad. It's quite interesting. Anyone can look at it when it's done. The ad lists murder, asbestos, AIDS, and nuclear war as things to be afraid of. But they hit the nail on the head when they compared secondhand smoke to the boogeyman and being afraid of the dark. They continue their scare tactics with the ever-available, inflated, computer-generated body count while neglecting to tell you 60% of these deaths occur over age 72 and eliminate other risk factors. They compare the tenuous link between secondhand smoke and heart disease, which by the EPA's own standard cannot be called a health risk. Heart disease has 300 cofactors, which include obesity, genetics, diet, exercise, race, and a host of others. The next lie in this ad states secondhand smoke causes sudden infant death syndrome. It is well known over 70% of the SIDS deaths are caused by a chronic abnormality which occurs before birth. The SIDS Foundation has asked them to stop using this lie, but there it is in our paper again. $153 million were lost in Ireland in the first 7 months of their ban. New York lost $77 million in revenues, $50 million in wages, and 3,000 jobs. California's ban cost 1,000 businesses and the jobs associated with those businesses.
Ms. Jeffers, could you please wrap up, please?
I'm on 2 seconds.
Thank you.
Okay. I emailed you guys all this stuff. You should have seen statistic after statistic, but I'm...
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Members, you're welcome to ask questions now of any of the witnesses or the authors or move amendments as you please. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to either of the author or the chief author, the co-author. Does your bill as it stands now apply to tribal reservations in the state?
Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, of course, we don't have jurisdiction over tribal reservations. It doesn't apply there. As it stands, it doesn't apply to the bars or the pubs or the clubs either that I think was addressed in testimony earlier. So to clarify that, those are a number of different areas where it doesn't apply.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Davids.
And to Representative Meslow, you say it doesn't apply to bars, do you still have the percentage of food served versus alcohol served in there?
Representative
Meslow. Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, yes, that's how it was handled out of the HHS committee, again, following the Olmsted County model with 50-50.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Meslow or Latz, one of the testifiers, Ryan, the guy with Minnesotans against smoking bans, yeah, that guy, he said that in the bill as it stands now, you would not allow counties or cities or townships to go stricter than what the state does. Is that correct?
Representative Meslow.
Chair, Representative Davids, that would be incorrect. There is a specific provision, and actually Mr. Pasika pointed that out, that would still give latitude to local government to enact more stringent provisions if they chose to.
Representative Davids.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, thank you, and thank you to those that came and testified. Everybody, I thought, did an excellent job. One thing that wasn't covered, I know there's a concern about border communities losing business as people go to, be it Wisconsin or wherever they may go. Do you folks have kind of a quick rundown of what the status of the law is in our neighboring states? And if there are any other similar measures that are being brought forth in our neighboring states.
Representative Latt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins. In North Dakota, the North Dakota Senate passed a smoking ban bill. It awaits action in the North Dakota House. Moorhead has passed a smoking ban. Part of its application was contingent on what Fargo did. Fargo passed a smoking ban, but one that was less restrictive than Moorhead's. And so as I understand it right now, Moorhead has cut theirs back to the equivalent to that in Fargo. That's my understanding. I'm not aware specifically of any other activity in other border communities. But I might add that every time you move up the governmental jurisdiction level, you get this question. The cities that jumped out front on this were concerned about creating an unlevel playing field vis-a-vis their neighboring cities. Same with the counties. And every jurisdiction that passed it has also expressed their preference that the state deal with it. Many jurisdictions, cities and counties that did not pass it, specifically said they want the state to pass something, so at least there's a level floor as between all the different jurisdictions. So we can only do something here in Minnesota. We certainly can't wait for the federal government to act to protect workers' health on this. But all of our cities and counties, many of our cities and counties are really asking the state to do it. And it's not just the cities and counties that are asking for that. The Greater Minneapolis Convention Visitors Bureau has embraced the smoking ban in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, but they have also endorsed a statewide smoking ban.
Representative Atkins,
Chair, thank you. It was just my understanding, Representative Latz, that there were movements afoot in our neighboring states, but I didn't know if they had made any progress, and I appreciate the update on North Dakota. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Latz.
Representative Atkins, there may be others that know more specifically about some of the border states, but I will tell you that some communities are concerned at their local levels about the state doing it, some border communities as well. The Northern Dakota County Chamber of Commerce, which represents 85% small businesses, has endorsed a statewide smoking ban bill. The Red Wing Republican Eagle, a border city, where the newspaper has editorialized in support of a statewide smoking ban, as has the AARP, the Health and Restaurant Employees Unions, and almost unanimously the health community. So it's a broad cross-section. Borders and non-border communities.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Blatt, I just heard you say that the employee unions have endorsed this, and I, again, still since the Health and Human Service committee meeting haven't had any employee groups come forward, and in fact I did ask one of them what their position was on this, and they said they didn't have a position. So I keep hearing about how the employees want this, but I'm not hearing that from the employees and nor any of their representatives at this time. So can you correct me on that?
Representative Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, yes, I can. I have a letter here signed by Wade Luneberg, Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Unite Here Unions, a hotel employee and restaurant employee union, in which they are specifically endorsing the statewide bill containing House File 405 before you today. I can share the letter with you if you like. It's also endorsed by quite a number of other organizations on this letter. If I may, in response to Representative Atkins as well, I'm informed South Dakota has a statewide law covering restaurants.
Which is what this bill would do. Representative Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Latz, when was that letter sent?
February 23rd, 2005.
Thank you.
I believe it was sent to quite a few representatives as well. I believe it was sent to all members of the Commerce Committee as well as other members of the House.
Representative Goodwin, I don't recall seeing it.
I would appreciate a copy of that so I know what the language is in it. I want to make sure that the union has passed, the union members have passed a resolution. As I said before, it's not effective if the president or whatever signs it, but only if the union has passed a resolution, the union members have passed a resolution to have it as part of their agenda. That's what makes up a union. Employees union is the membership. So if the membership has said that they have endorsed this through a resolution process, then it's endorsed. If the president has said they endorse it, it isn't endorsed by the membership, and I don't know what they did with this, and that would be very significant. So if they did, I'd like to know that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, you'd have to ask Mr. Luneberg what authority he had to sign this letter on behalf of his union as their elected official. I'd be surprised if he went so far out on a limb. They also appeared at the press conference in which this bill was introduced. So either someone's really out on a limb or they're acting with their union support.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to either representative. Most of the bars that have contacted me in District 31B are still concerned. They're saying, you know, we say that we've exempted the bars, but most of them serve more than 50% food versus the alcohol. Down District 31B, we're more hungry than thirsty. So would you say that in that case, then it's not really an exemption to the bars? So if they're serving more than 50, if most of the receipts are from food rather than alcohol, are we in effect then banning them from smoking in those bars?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, the 50-50 was something that was proposed out of the Health and Human Services Committee and designed off the Olmsted County model. I had heard about the Olmsted County model certainly prior to the amendment being proposed, and I've asked people really on all sides of the issue if there is a where the 50-50 number came from. The only information I've been able to get back in response is that was a number that was picked that appeared fair and that has been working, but there hasn't been an analysis to specifically say whether a bar becomes a restaurant at 40-60 or 60-40. My sense is I know it when I walk in. But the numbers themselves are really based upon a model that was deemed to have been working to this point in Rochester. I can't tell you how it hits the pavement with individual restaurants, bars.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Representative Mizzle. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if you serve more than 50% food, then you'd be considered a restaurant and you would have a smoking ban.
Representative Mizzle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids. Yes, by dollar value, yes, in terms of where the revenue is derived.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for either Representative Latz or Representative Meslow,
help me understand, is part of the intent of this bill to reduce smoking? Because I heard some of the testifiers say that they projected that smoking would in fact be reduced if the bill were to be enacted.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I don't know if that would be an effect to the bill or not. That's not what the bill is designed for, in my perspective. It's not to reduce smoking, and for that matter, I don't view it as something that is designed to protect patrons, because as I see it, a patron can go to another establishment, can go to a non-smoking section. From my perspective, this is about protecting employees. This is about looking at people who are exposed throughout a shift to what has been determined to be a known physical danger, to take lives. And while it would be nice to say that those people can go work someplace else, when we look at a lot of those people, we're talking about a 19-year-old man who's going to college during the day and looking for a nighttime part-time job to work his way through college, or a 25-year-old woman who's a stay-at-home mom, and then when her husband comes home, she's going out and providing that second income in the evening, so there's always somebody with the child. And those people don't have those same kind of options that we do if we want to go eat at a different restaurant or eat in a different section. And to my mind, it is protecting the health and the lives of those people. That's the reason that this bill exists.
Representative Foles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, you and I had a chance to talk briefly about the bill, and I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on that. I think that employees, regardless if they're 17, 18, or 25, have a choice to go work somewhere else, somewhere a non-smoking environment. But that being said, I did hear some testimony about the fact that this bill is likely to reduce the amount of smoking, and in light of that, I'm wondering, and in fact I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe that one of the proponents of the bill said something to the effect of 10%, and that maybe is overstating somebody's testimony, but I'm curious if there's been a fiscal note or a revenue note requested on the bill, and if Chairman Krinke has asked to see it, because I think if we are talking about reducing the amount of smoking, which is not necessarily a bad idea. In fact, it's a laudable goal, one that I support. But there are tax implications, revenue implications. I'm wondering if a revenue note's been requested and if Chairman Krinke intends to see the bill.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that has not occurred to my mind. It was an observation from somebody's testimony, but I think it's quite speculative whether that would happen, particularly as we're talking about restaurants rather than bars. In a restaurant situation, frankly, most restaurants make their profit on turning tables over. They're looking for customers who will be there for 30 to 40 minutes and then move on. And I would be surprised, just my own personal estimate, I would be surprised if it affected people's decisions as to whether they're going to continue smoking or not. I would be surprised if it reduced smoking.
Representative Foles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, thank you. I was surprised a couple of years ago to have a fiscal note on a bill that I didn't think was going to have any fiscal implications, and the note was based on some testimony in a committee that somebody came in. So if the bill gets out of here today, that may be something we need to consider. I guess the same question goes with the gambling revenues as well. There was some testimony from one of the opponents of the bill that a lot of smoking happens in places that sell a lot of pull tabs, a lot of charitable gambling, and there certainly are revenue implications there. I think that if the bill gets out of committee today, that may be something that that you and Representative Latz ought to address as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Coles, in response to that point, the bill in front of you exempts bars, which is where most of the, and it exempts private clubs, including service clubs, such as VFWs, and that's where almost all of the pull tabs and other charitable gambling takes place. So although it may be a concern in some arenas, it should not be a concern for the bill in front of you today.
Representative Hollis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a couple of questions, but Representative Latz just made a statement about VFWs and charitable gaming. What would this bill do to Canterbury?
Representative Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, I don't know what this bill would do to Canterbury. I don't know where the revenues how the revenues in terms of restaurant, food, or alcohol is compared, and I don't know what charitable gaming they have going on there. But I think the ultimate question is whether or not they are a restaurant or a bar. And if they would be considered a bar, then they'd be exempt. If they'd be considered a restaurant, then they wouldn't be. But Mr. Chairman, Representative House, surveys around the state have shown that three times as many people say they're more likely to go to a restaurant that is smoke-free than are less likely to go. That's why I think the numbers that you've seen in the economic studies indicate that restaurants either hold their own or increase their attendance. Now, I don't know, people who go to Canterbury may be more likely to take risks in a lot of ways, including with their own health. So the problem is they're also taking risks with the employees' health where they are at. And I challenge anyone to say in a small town where there is only one bar or one restaurant that waitress can quit that bar or restaurant job and go find a job in another bar or restaurant in that small town. These are real keeping the apartment over house over the head kind of issues for a lot of employees as well as their own health.
Representative House?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for answering my question. I think you answered it. But a statement before I ask another question, it seems to me we would put Canterbury at a very great risk in comparison to Mystic Lake being able to have a better advantage, and also many people that stand outside, sit outside and watch the races. We're going to have to now figure out how to divide that area, and it's going to put them at a great disadvantage, I believe. But I have a question here.
If I might just briefly, Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, it would not affect the outdoor seating area, and I was actually thinking that, having spent a fair amount of my own time and a fair amount of my own money at Canterbury Park, certainly there's a significant amount of outdoor seating, and I that would not be impacted by this legislation at all.
Representative House.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I won't go after that anymore. But my question is on private clubs. In one place here has owned or rented a building or space in a building for more than a year, suitable for the adequate accommodation of its members. First question, I'll give both questions so we don't take any more time, but who determines whether it's suitable or adequate? And my second question would be further down in that section, was not established to avoid compliance with sections 144.414. How do we determine if they establish it to avoid or not avoid the compliance?
Representative Meslow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howes, I think that would be fairly straightforward as if it suddenly cropped up as a new business or as a changed business, that's something that would have to be evaluated. Again, this is language. Part of what's a little tricky is this is language that came out of the HHS committee, and so and very likely something. The question that you're asking is one that would be perhaps tinkered with in civil law. That would probably be the most appropriate place for us to sort through those language issues.
Representative House,
Mr. Chairman, is that the next step, civil law?
Yes. Correct.
Well, Representative Meslow, if you make it to civil law, or if when you're in civil law, would you try to define that a little better, maybe even make it the health inspector, fire marshal, or something, to define who decides it's suitable or not?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howes, I think that's a question that would be appropriate to address to civil law, and that's where they can be doing some wordsmithing that I think is oftentimes a big part of their task.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and representatives. I had a couple questions. Well, I have one really question that I raised my hand to ask, but I have to also, before I do that, respond to Representative Coles, who was talking about the loss of tax revenue from smokers. And I have to say, you know, somebody testified earlier that there is $7.18 per pack in health costs and lost productivity. Boy, oh boy, if we lose revenue because smokers stop smoking, I'm all for that. I can't imagine that the state of Minnesota wants to get its money off of the death and disability of its citizens. So, I mean, we do that, and maybe we'll end up doing more of that on the theory that more taxes means less smoking. But to view that as a negative, I view that as a positive if we can get people to stop. But my question related to something that was brought up about the air quality testing. And I've heard this before, and I have to, and I'd like some response to that. When I look at this, what was handed out, it was Mr. Wernemont who started talking about this, and then Ms. Jeffers continued talking about it. And when he was testifying, he talked about this being a nicotine level that was being measured in the air. And then in his materials here, it talks about somehow a level of secondhand smoke concentration. And I was not aware that there was a measurement that the OSHA did secondhand smoke concentrations. I think it usually, if I'm not mistaken, it relates to one or another compound. And we had testimony before that there was arsenic and formaldehyde in cigarette smoke. So I wonder if we could get just some clarification on that, because I'm afraid that leaving numbers like this out there, if we're just talking about a nicotine level, I mean, if only that were the only problem with secondhand smoke.
Representative Liebling, I'll let the author answer that, but with regard to Representative Cole's question, it really doesn't matter whether it's a positive fiscal impact or a negative fiscal impact. If there's a fiscal impact, it needs a fiscal note or a revenue note.
Well, that's fine, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to simply respond to that notion, because to me it doesn't matter how it comes out.
It's a good point, Representative Meswell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it struck me, and obviously it's always hard to anticipate when someone's going to pull out a statistic and to address that statistic. It struck me as I listened to the testimony that there was one thing that was consistent when people were talking about the health issue. And that was that everyone who talked to you about a health issue, pro and con, was going to find their business reduced as the result of a smoking ban. Not only Mr. Wernemont and Ms. Jeffers, but all of the medical people came in and testified, this will reduce our business. And that was the consistency that I saw as I heard that, as everybody was saying, either they were worried that it was going to affect their business or they were glad it was going to affect their business, but everyone was saying, a smoking ban will give us less business. That was what they were truly saying when they were talking, and it was a medical issue. And I would simply say that when we're talking about medical issues, we heard from the experts. Those are the people that I would rely on, and if I had a heart problem, a lung problem, I know where I'd go, and I know who I'd be listening to.
Representative Liebling, any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Gunther. Oh, sorry.
I'm going to respond to the St. Louis Park issue, since I represent St. Louis Park. St. Louis Park does not have a Department of Health. For starters, the county has a Department of Health. St. Louis Park has a Director of Inspections and an Inspections Department, and they conducted this nicotine testing and disclosure program. They make no representations about there being any safe level of secondhand smoke consumption. I think the quote was that the St. Louis Park has provided scientific proof that nicotine at certain levels is safe. That's flat out false. They are not scientists. They conducted testing of particles in the air. They don't make any representations about safety of it. And OSHA does not say that there is any safe level of intake of cigarette smoke or its components. OSHA was in rulemaking process, and in 2001 they suspended the rulemaking process for a clean indoor air standard, acknowledging that the assessment and the rulemaking process, which had started in 1987, have been unproductive, and that most activity on the workplace issues were occurring on the state and local level. So there are no OSHA standards for safe intake of cigarette smoke.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To either one of the author or co-author, is the fact that the city of Fairmont, as well as many other communities throughout Minnesota, have a rule in order to get a liquor permit, you have to serve 50% or more of food. So in the city of Fairmont, as well as many other communities, there will be no place you can smoke in any bar or restaurant. And I find the lack of choice is kind of tough, because one law conflicts with another. But on top of that, what I would like to know is what happens if somebody violates the smoking ban. What measurements go on? I know what happens in Minneapolis is a bar owner had a heart attack, I guess, trying to stop somebody and had to go to the hospital. But what happens under your bill?
Representative
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, there is a penalty provision in the bill which makes it a petty misdemeanor for an individual who lights a cigarette in an environment where it's prohibited under the Clean Indoor Air Act. The Clean Indoor Air Act now also has an administrative enforcement mechanism, which covers the entire Department of Health, not just the Clean Indoor Air Act, and that's handled administratively. So there's
what you're telling me then is we are now starting smoking cops, and one of the unfunded mandates that we're giving them is if there's someone smoking, the bar owner has to repeat that, and the local law enforcement has to come and deal with these people and take them to jail or what. And if they don't do that, if the bar owner doesn't do that, and some patron reports that bar owner, what is going to happen to the bar owner?
Representative Meslow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I guess what I'd like to address is that petty misdemeanor provision is actually existing law in all the other workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
I will simply tell you that as a city prosecutor since 1988, responsible for enforcing petty misdemeanor, and gross misdemeanor charges, I haven't seen one yet.
Representative Gunther.
In other words, you're telling me that there will be no smoking cops and the effect of this law will be nothing.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, no, what I'm saying is that the public awareness and public acceptance of it has led to the problem resolving itself without the need for law enforcement to step in. And that's been true. That's been true with the existing law, and I would expect that the same would be true with this going forward, as we're simply expanding the existing situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gazelka, and then we need to wrap up and take a vote.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, I'm concerned about the penalties as well, and I've asked Mr. Pender to try to help me here. But in worst case scenarios, it looks like the Commissioner of Health can give fines up to $10,000 and 90 days of prison time. There's all kinds of things on the other end of it that appear to be part of it, but there's no clarity in your bill about that, and so that's something I'm concerned about.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gazelka, my belief is that that's incorrect. I don't think that there would be any, I don't see any criminal liability either provided by this statute or in other places, and any criminal violation needs to be clearly stated within the statute or it can't apply. So when you talk about 90 days, I don't believe that that's possible. I don't believe one day is possible. I believe that the $10,000 administrative penalty is potentially the most severe penalty that could be issued.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment. I appreciate both of you bringing this bill forward. It's an important bill, I believe. And I do have a handout here that I didn't get out to the members, but it's from the Philip Morris Society, basically. They're talking about the problems with secondhand smoke. It said, we believe the conclusions of the public health officials concerning environmental tobacco smoke are sufficient to warrant measures that regulate smoking in public places. This is the guys who make the cigarettes are saying it's up to the public policymakers to make the decision here to regulate smoking. And what we've heard today is testimony about child endangerment. We've heard testimony about workers' health care. And I guess, you know, to me, these are public policies that we as policymakers have a responsibility to our constituents to have a fair hearing on. And there are health issues with which we are, as policymakers, we create the infrastructure for economic development, and we also create an environment where they can dwell safely. And I think for us as policymakers as well, part of our edict is to listen to our constituents. And I think probably the most of you, if you've put it on your survey, find that your constituents are about 70-80% in favor of a public smoking ban. And for us to go against the edict of those that are voting for us to office, we better have a real good reason not to do that. So I encourage us as legislators, as decision makers here today, to do the right thing and vote for this smoking ban.
Representative Latz and Representative Meslow, would you like to make one concluding comment briefly, and then we're going to take a vote?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To pick up on Representative Severson's comments about public support, the University of Minnesota School of Epidemiology did a survey of 17 rural counties in Minnesota in 2002, and they found in, for example, Chisago County, that 80% of the survey respondents believed that restaurant workers had a right to work in a smoke-free environment. In St. Louis County, it was 79%. In response to the question of whether or not smoking should be allowed in a restaurant, in Chisago County, 57% said no, absolutely no smoking in a restaurant. St. Louis County, it was 55%. And 81% in Chisago County and 76% in St. Louis County said they preferred a smoke-free restaurant. That's consistent with a survey conducted in the last year in Meeker County that found that 74% of the residents supported a smoking ban in restaurants and bars. Members, Lexington, Kentucky, the heart of tobacco country, has passed a smoking ban. If they can do it, certainly Minnesota can.
Thank you, as well.
If I might just follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I appreciate all of your attention. I'll take a different tack. This is a health issue. This is about saving lives. And there is no doubt that secondhand smoke causes heart disease, causes lung disease, causes cancer. There is no doubt that this bill will save lives. Your balance is to take a look at that versus the potential impact on businesses. And I think statistics are hard to measure, but there's a potential impact there, and I won't pretend otherwise. But I will tell you this. A restaurant can adapt. A restaurant can adjust to a smoking ban. Our businesses can adapt, and they will. A person cannot grow another lung. They will die. The choice that we have is whether to focus on saving lives or whether to focus on protecting that issue on businesses. My choice is to focus on health. My choice is to focus on saving lives. And that's why I've gone forward with this bill.
Thank you. The chair renews his motion that House File 405, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The bill is not passed. Thank you. We have the minutes of the Representative Zellers moves the minutes of the March 1st meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And we are in recess, or adjourned.